be invisible. He will come in the night, like the angel that blasted the Assyrians. He will be silent. How much better for us all if there had been a Father Gomez in the Garden of Eden. We would never have left Paradise.
The young priest was nearly weeping with pride. The court gave its blessing. And in the darkest corner of the ceiling, hidden among the dark oak beams, sat a man no larger than a handspan. His heels were armed with spurs, and he heard every word they said. In the cellars, the man from Bolvanger, dressed only in a dirty white shirt and loose trousers with no belt, stood under the bare light bulb, clutching the trousers with one hand and his rabbit demon with the other. In front of him, in the only chair, sat Father MacPhail.
"Dr. Cooper,"
the president began,
"do sit down."
There was no furniture except the chair, the wooden bunk, and a bucket. The president's voice echoed unpleasantly off the white tiles that lined the wall and ceiling. Dr. Cooper sat on the bunk. He could not take his eyes off the gaunt and grey-haired president. He licked his dry lips and waited to see what new discomfort was coming.
"So you nearly succeeded in severing the child from her demon,"
said Father MacPhail. Dr. Cooper said shakily,
"We considered that it would serve no purpose to wait, since the experiment was due to take place anyway, and we put the child in the experimental chamber. But then Mrs. Coulter herself intervened and took the child to her own quarters."
The rabbit demon opened her round eyes and gazed fearfully at the president, and then shut them again and hid her face.
"That must have been distressing."
"The whole program was intensely difficult."
"I am surprised you did not seek the aid of the consistorial court, but we have strong nerves."
We understood that the program was licensed by... It was an oblation board matter, but we were told it had the approval of the consistorial court of discipline. We would never have taken part otherwise. Never."
"No, of course not. And now for another matter. Did you have any idea,"
said Father MacPhail, turning to the real subject of his visit to the cellars,
"of the subject of Lord Asriel's researches, of what might have been the source of the colossal energy he managed to release on Svalbard?"
Dr. Cooper swallowed. In the intense silence, a drop of sweat fell from his chin to the concrete floor, and both men heard it distinctly.
"Well, there was one of our team who observed that in the process of severance, there was a release of energy. Controlling it would involve enormous forces, but just as an atomic explosion is detonated by conventional explosives, this could be done by focusing a powerful anbaric current. However, he wasn't taken seriously. I paid no attention to his ideas, knowing that without authority they might well be heretical."
"Very wise. And that colleague now, where is he?"
"He was one of those who died in the attack."
The president smiled. It was so kindly an expression that Dr. Cooper's demon shivered and swooned against his breast.
"Courage, Dr. Cooper. We need you to be strong and brave. There is great work to be done, a great battle to be fought. You must earn the forgiveness of the authority by cooperating fully with us, by holding nothing back, not even wild speculation, not even gossip. Now, I want you to devote all your attention to what you remember your colleague saying. Did he make any experiments? Did he leave any notes? Did he take anyone else into his confidence? What equipment was he using? Think of everything, Dr. Cooper. You'll have pen and paper, and all the time you need. Now, this room is not very comfortable. We'll have you move to somewhere more suitable. Is there anything you need in the way of furnishing, for example? Do you prefer to write at a table or a desk? Would you like a typewriting machine? Perhaps you would rather dictate to a stenographer. Let the guards know, and you shall have everything you need. But every moment, Dr. Cooper, I want you to think back to your colleague and his theory. Your great task is to recall and, if necessary, to rediscover what he knew. Once you know what instruments you require, you shall have those as well. It is a great task, Dr. Cooper. You are blessed to be entrusted with it. Give thanks to the authority.
I do, Father President. I do.
Grasping the loose waistband of his trousers, the philosopher stood up and bowed almost without realizing it again and again, as the president of the Consistorial Court of Discipline left his cell. That evening, the Chevalier Tialis, the Gallivespian spy, made his way through the lanes and alleys of Geneva to meet his colleague, the Lady Salmakia. It was a dangerous journey for both of them, dangerous for anyone or anything that challenged them too, but certainly full of peril for the small Gallivespians. More than one prowling cat had met its death at their spurs, but only the week before, the Chevalier had nearly lost an arm to the teeth of a mangy dog. Only the lady's swift action had saved him. They met at the seventh of their appointed meeting places, among the roots of a plane tree in a shabby little square, and exchanged their news. The Lady Salmakia's contact in the society had told her that earlier that evening they had received a friendly invitation from the President of the Consistorial Court to come and discuss matters of mutual interest.
"Quick work,"
said the Chevalier.
100 to 1 he doesn't tell them about his assassin, though.
He told her about the plan to kill Lyra. She was not surprised.
"It's the logical thing to do. Very logical people. Tialis, do you think we shall ever see this child?"
"I don't know, but I should like to. Go well, Salmakia. Tomorrow, at the fountain."
Unsaid behind that brief exchange was the one thing they never spoke of, the shortness of their lives compared with those of humans. Gallivespians lived to 9 years or 10, rarely more, and Tialis and Salmakia were both in their 8th year. They didn't fear old age. Their people died in the full strength and vigour of their prime, suddenly, and their childhoods were very brief. But compared with their lives, the life of a child like Lyra would extend as far into the future as the lives of the witches extended past Lyra's own. The Chevalier returned to the College of St. Jerome and began to compose the message he would send to Lord Roke on the lodestone resonator. But while Tialis was at the rendezvous talking to Salmakia, the President sent for Father Gomez. In his study they prayed together for an hour, and then Father MacPhail granted the young priest the preemptive absolution that would make his murder of Lyra no murder at all. Father Gomez seemed transfigured. The certainty that ran through his veins seemed to make his very eyes incandescent. They discussed practical arrangements, money and so forth, and then the President said,
"Once you leave here, Father Gomez, you will be completely cut off forever from any help we can give. You can never come back. You will never hear from us. I can't offer you any better advice than this. Don't look for the child. That would give you away. Instead, look for the tempter. Follow the tempter, and she will lead you to the child."
"She?"
said Father Gomez.
"Yes, she. We have learned that much from the alethiometer. The world the tempter comes from is a strange one. You will see many things that will shock and startle you, Father Gomez. Don't let yourself be distracted by their oddness from the sacred task you have to do. I have faith in the power of your faith. This woman is traveling, guided by the powers of evil, to a place where she may eventually meet the child in time to tempt her. That is, of course, if we do not succeed in removing the girl from a present location. That remains our first plan. You, Father Gomez, are our ultimate guarantee that if that falls through, the infernal powers will still not prevail."
Father Gomez nodded. His demon, a large and iridescent green-backed beetle, clicked her wing cases. The President opened a drawer and handed the young priest a folded packet of papers.
"Here is all we know about the woman, and the world she comes from and the place she was last seen. Read it well, my dear Luis, and go with my blessing."
He had never used the priest's given name before. Father Gomez felt tears of joy prick his eyes as he kissed the President farewell.
Evening. You're Lyra.
Then she realized what that meant. She felt dizzy, even in her dream. She felt a great burden settle on her shoulders. And to make it even heavier, sleep was closing in again, and Roger's face was receding into shadow.
Well, I know. There's all kinds of people on our side, like Dr. Malone. You know, there's another Oxford, Roger, just like ours. Well, I found her and she'd help. But there's only one person really who...
It was almost impossible now to see the little boy, and her thoughts were spreading out and wandering away like sheep in a field.
But we can trust him, Roger, I swear,
she said with a final effort. Chapter 7 Mary Alone.
Last rose as in dance the stately trees, and spread their branches hung with copious fruit. John Milton.
Almost at the same time, the tempter whom Father Gomez was setting out to follow was being tempted herself.
Thank you. No, no, that's all I need. No more, honestly. Thank you,
said Dr. Mary Malone to the old couple in the olive grove as they tried to give her more food than she could carry. They lived here isolated and childless, and they had been afraid of the spectres they'd seen among the silver-grey trees. But when Mary Malone came up the road with her rucksack, the spectres had taken fright and drifted away. The old couple had welcomed Mary into their little vine-sheltered farmhouse, had plied her with wine and cheese and bread and olives, and now didn't want to let her go.
I must go on. Thank you. You've been very kind. Oh, I can't carry... Oh, all right. Another little cheese. Thank you.
They evidently saw her as a talisman against the spectres. She wished she could be. In her week in the world of Chittagatse, she had seen enough devastation, enough spectre-eaten adults and wild scavenging children, to have a horror of those ethereal vampires. All she knew was that they did drift away when she approached, but she couldn't stay with everyone who wanted her to, because she had to move on. She found room for the last little goat's cheese wrapped in its vine leaf, smiled and bowed again, and took a last drink from the spring that bubbled up among the grey rocks. Then she clapped her hands gently together as the old couple were doing, and turned firmly away and left. She looked more decisive than she felt. The last communication with those entities she called shadow particles, and Lyra called dust, had been on the screen of her computer, and at their instruction she had destroyed that. Now she was at a loss. They'd told her to go through the opening in the Oxford she had lived in, the Oxford of Will's world, which she'd done, to find herself dizzy and quaking with wonder in this extraordinary other world. Beyond that, her only task was to find the boy and the girl, and then play the serpent, whatever that meant. So she'd walked and explored and inquired, and found nothing. But now, she thought, as she turned up the little track away from the olive grove, she would have to look for guidance. Once she was far enough away from the little farmstead to be sure she wouldn't be disturbed, she sat under the pine trees and opened her rucksack. At the bottom, wrapped in a silk scarf, was a book she'd had for 20 years, a commentary on the Chinese method of divination, the I Ching. She had taken it with her for two reasons. One was sentimental. Her grandfather had given it to her, and she had used it a lot as a schoolgirl. The other was that when Lyra had first found her way to Mary's laboratory, she had asked, "What's that?" and pointed to the poster on the door that showed the symbols from the I Ching. And shortly afterwards, in her spectacular reading of the computer, Lyra had learned, she claimed, that dust had many other ways of speaking to human beings, and one of them was the method from China that used those symbols. So in her swift packing to leave her own world, Mary Malone had taken with her the Book of Changes, as it was called, and the little yarrow stalks with which she read it, and now the time had come to use them. She spread the silk on the ground, and began the process of dividing and counting and setting aside, which she'd done so often as a passionate, curious teenager, and hardly ever since. She had almost forgotten how to do it, but she soon found the ritual coming back, and with it a sense of that calm and concentrated attention that played such an important part in talking to the shadows. Eventually she came to the numbers that indicated the hexagram she was being given, the group of six broken or unbroken lines, and then she looked up the meaning. This was the difficult part, because the book expressed itself in such an enigmatic style. She read, "Turning to the summit for provision of nourishment brings good fortune. Spying about with sharp eyes like a tiger with insatiable craving." That seemed encouraging. She read on, following the commentary through the mazy paths it led her on, until she came to, "Keeping still is the mountain. It is a bypath. It means little stones, doors, and openings." She had to guess. The mention of openings recalled the mysterious window in the air through which she had entered this world, and the first word seemed to say that she should go upwards. Both puzzled and encouraged, she packed the book and the yarrow stalks away and set off up the path. 4 hours later, she was very hot and tired. The sun was low over the horizon. The rough track she was following had petered out, and she was clambering with more and more discomfort among tumbled boulders and smaller stones. To her left, the slope fell away towards a landscape of olive and lemon groves, of poorly tended vineyards and abandoned windmills, lying hazy in the evening light. To her right, a scree of small rocks and gravel sloped up to a cliff of crumbling limestone. Wearily she hoisted her rucksack again and set her foot on the next flat stone, but before she even transferred her weight, she stopped. The light was catching something curious, and she shaded her eyes against the glare from the scree and tried to find it again. And there it was. Like a sheet of glass hanging unsupported in the air, but glass with no attention-catching reflections in it, just a square patch of difference. And then she remembered what the I Ching had said. A bypath. Little stones, doors, and openings. It was a window like the one in Sunderland Avenue in Oxford. She could only see it because of the light. With the sun any higher, it probably wouldn't show up at all. She approached the little patch of air with passionate curiosity, because she hadn't had time to look at the first one. She'd had to get away as quickly as possible. But she examined this one in detail, touching the edge, moving around to see how it became invisible from the other side, noting the absolute difference between this and that, and found her mind almost bursting with excitement that such things could be. The knife-bearer who had made it, at about the time of the American Revolution, had been too careless to close it, but at least he'd cut through at a point very similar to the world on this side, next to a rock face. But the rock on the other side was different, not limestone but granite, and as Mary stepped through into the new world she found herself not at the foot of a towering cliff, but almost at the top of a low outcrop overlooking a vast plain. It was evening here, too, and she sat down to breathe the air and rest her limbs and taste the wonder without rushing. Wide golden light, and an endless prairie or savanna, like nothing she had ever seen in her own world. To begin with, although most of it was covered in short grass and an infinite variety of buff, brown, green, ochre, yellow, golden shades, and undulating very gently in the way that the long evening light showed up clearly, the prairie seemed to be laced through and through with what looked like rivers of rock with a light grey surface. And secondly, here and there on the plain were stands of the tallest trees Mary had ever seen. Attending a high-energy physics conference once in California, she had taken time out to look at the great redwood trees and marveled. But whatever these trees were, they would have overtopped the redwoods by half again at least. Their foliage was dense and dark green, their vast trunks gold-red in the heavy evening light. And finally, herds of creatures, too far off to see distinctly, grazed on the prairie. There was a strangeness about their movement that she couldn't quite work out. She was desperately tired, and thirsty and hungry besides. Somewhere nearby, though, she heard the welcome trickle of a spring, and only a minute later she found it, just a seepage of clear water from a mossy fissure, and a tiny stream that led away down the slope. She drank long and gratefully, and filled her bottles, and then set about making herself comfortable, for night was falling rapidly. Propped against the rock, wrapped in her sleeping bag, she ate some of the rough bread and the goat's cheese, and then fell deeply asleep. She awoke with the early sun full in her face. The air was cool, and the dew had settled in tiny beads on her hair and on the sleeping bag. She lay for a few minutes lapped in freshness, feeling as if she were the first human being who had ever lived. She sat up, yawned, stretched, shivered, and washed in the chilly spring before eating a couple of dried figs and taking stock of the place. Behind the little rise she had found herself on, the land sloped gradually down and then up again. The fullest view lay in front, across that immense prairie. The long shadows of the trees lay towards her now, and she could see flocks of birds wheeling in front of them, so small against the towering green canopy that they looked like motes of dust. Loading her rucksack again, she made her way down onto the coarse, rich grass of the prairie, aiming for the nearest stand of trees, 4 or 5 miles away. The grass was knee-high, and growing among it were low-lying bushes no higher than her ankles of something like juniper, and there were flowers like poppies, like buttercups, like cornflowers, giving a haze of different tints to the landscape. And then she saw a large bee, the size of the top segment of her thumb, visiting a blue flower head and making it bend and sway. But as it backed out of the petals and took to the air again, she saw that it was no insect. For a moment later it made for her hand and perched on her finger, dipping a long, needle-like beak against her skin with the utmost delicacy, and then taking flight again when it found no nectar. It was a minute hummingbird, its bronze-feathered wings moving too fast for her to see. How every biologist on Earth would envy her if they could see what she was seeing. She moved on, and found herself getting closer to a herd of those grazing creatures she had seen the previous evening, whose movement had puzzled her without her knowing why. They were about the size of deer or antelopes, and similarly coloured, but what made her stop still and rub her eyes was the arrangement of their legs. They grew in a diamond formation, 2 in the centre, 1 at the front, and 1 under the tail, so that the animals moved with a curious rocking motion. Mary longed to examine a skeleton and see how the structure worked. For their part, the grazing creatures regarded her with mild, incurious eyes, showing no alarm. She would have loved to go closer and take time to look at them, but it was getting hot, and the shade of the great trees looked inviting, and there was plenty of time after all. Before long, she found herself stepping out of the grass onto one of those rivers of stone she'd seen from the hill, something else to wonder at. It might once have been some kind of lava flow. The underlying colour was dark, almost black, but the surface was paler as if it had been ground down or worn by crushing. It was as smooth as a stretch of well-laid road in Mary's own world, and certainly easier to walk on than the grass. She followed the one she was on, which flowed in a wide curve towards the trees. The closer she got, the more astounded she was by the enormous size of the trunks, as wide, she estimated, as the house she lived in, and as tall as... She couldn't even make a guess. When she came to the first trunk, she rested her hands on the deeply ridged red-gold bark. The ground was covered ankle-deep in brown leaf skeletons as long as her hand, soft and fragrant to walk on. She was soon surrounded by a cloud of midge-like flying things, as well as a little flock of the tiny hummingbirds, a yellow butterfly with a wing spread as broad as her hand, and too many crawling things for comfort. The air was full of humming and buzzing and scraping. She walked along the floor of the grove, feeling much as if she were in a cathedral. There was the same stillness, the same sense of upwardness in the structures, the same awe within herself. It had taken her longer than she thought it would to walk here. It was getting on towards midday, for the shafts of light coming down through the canopy were almost vertical. Drowsily, Mary wondered why the grazing creatures didn't move under the shade of the trees during this hottest part of the day. She soon found out. Feeling too hot to move any further, she lay down to rest between the roots of one of the giant trees with her head on her rucksack, and fell into a doze. Her eyes were closed for 20 minutes or so, and she was not quite asleep, when suddenly, from very close by, there came a resounding crash that shook the ground. Then came another. Alarmed, Mary sat up and gathered her wits and saw a movement that resolved itself into a round object, about 3 feet across, rolling along the ground, coming to a halt, and falling on its side. And then another fell, further off. She saw the massive thing descend and watched it crash into the buttress-like root of the nearest trunk and roll away. The thought of one of those things falling on her was enough to make her take her rucksack and run out of the grove altogether. What were they? Seed pods? Watching carefully upwards, she ventured under the canopy again to look at the nearest of the fallen objects. She pulled it upright and rolled it out of the grove and then laid it on the grass to look at it more closely. It was perfectly circular and as thick as the width of her palm. There was a depression in the centre where it had been attached to the tree. It wasn't heavy, but it was immensely hard and covered in fibrous hairs which lay along the circumference so that she could run her hand around it easily one way, but not the other. She tried her knife on the surface. It made no impression at all. Her fingers seemed smoother. She smelled them. There was a faint fragrance there under the smell of dust. She looked at the seed pod again. In the centre there was a slight glistening, and as she touched it again, she felt it slide easily under her fingers. It was exuding a kind of oil. Mary laid the thing down and thought about the way this world had evolved. If her guess about these universes was right, and they were the multiple worlds predicted by quantum theory, then some of them would have split off from her own much earlier than others. And clearly in this world, evolution had favoured enormous trees and large creatures with a diamond-framed skeleton. She was beginning to see how narrow her scientific horizons were. No botany, no geology, no biology of any sort. She was as ignorant as a baby. And then she heard a low, thunder-like rumble, which was hard to locate until she saw a cloud of dust moving along one of the roads, towards the stand of trees and towards her. It was about a mile away, but it wasn't moving slowly, and all of a sudden she felt afraid. She darted back into the grove. She found a narrow space between two great roots and crammed herself into it, peering over the buttress beside her and out towards the approaching dust cloud. What she saw made her head spin. At first it looked like a motorcycle gang. Then she thought it was a herd of wheeled animals. But that was impossible. No animal could have wheels. She wasn't seeing it. But she was. There were a dozen or so. They were roughly the same size as the grazing creatures, but leaner and grey-coloured, with horned heads and short trunks like elephants. They had the same diamond-shaped structure as the grazers, but somehow they had evolved, on their front and rear single legs, a wheel. But wheels did not exist in nature, her mind insisted. They couldn't. You needed an axle with a bearing that was completely separate from the rotating part. It couldn't happen. It was impossible. Then, as they came to a halt not 50 yards away, and the dust settled, she suddenly made the connection, and she couldn't help laughing out loud with a little cough of delight. The wheels were seed pods. Perfectly round, immensely hard and light, they couldn't have been designed better. The creatures hooked a claw through the centre of the pods with their front and rear legs, and used their two lateral legs to push against the ground and move along. While she marvelled at this, she was also a little anxious, for their horns looked formidably sharp, and even at this distance she could see intelligence and curiosity in their gaze. And they were looking for her. One of them had spotted the seed pod she had taken out of the grove, and he trundled off the road towards it. When he reached it, he lifted it onto an edge with his trunk and rolled it over to his companions. They gathered around the pod and touched it delicately with those powerful, flexible trunks, and she found herself interpreting the soft chirrups and clicks and hoots they were making as expressions of disapproval. Someone had tampered with this. It was wrong. Then she thought, I came here for a purpose, although I don't understand it yet. Be bold. Take the initiative. So she stood up and very self-consciously called,
Over here! This is where I am. I looked at your seed pod. I'm sorry. Please don't harm me.
Instantly their heads snapped around, trunks held out, glittering eyes facing forward. Their ears had all flicked upright. She stepped out of the shelter of the roots and faced them directly. She held out her hands, realizing that such a gesture might mean nothing to creatures with no hands themselves. Still, it was all she could do. Picking up her rucksack, she walked across the grass and stepped onto the road. Close up, not 5 steps away, she could see much more about their appearance, but her attention was held by something lively and aware in their gaze, by an intelligence. These creatures were as different from the grazing animals nearby as a human was from a cow. Mary pointed to herself and said,
Mary.
The nearest creature reached forward with its trunk. She moved closer and it touched her on the breast, where she had pointed, and she heard her voice coming back to her from the creature's throat.
Mary. What are you?
She said.
What are you?
The creature responded.
I am a human,
she said.
I am a human,
said the creature, and then something even odder happened. The creatures laughed. Their eyes wrinkled, their trunks waved, they tossed their heads, and from their throats came the unmistakable sound of merriment. She couldn't help it. She laughed, too. Then another creature moved forward and touched her hand with its trunk. Mary offered her other hand as well to its soft, bristled, questing touch.
Ah, oh, you're smelling the oil from the seed pod.
Seed pod, said the creature.
If you can make the sounds of my language, we might be able to communicate one day. God knows how. Mary,
she said, pointing to herself again. Nothing. They watched. She did it again.
Mary.
The nearest creature touched its own breast with its trunk and spoke. Was it three syllables or two? The creature spoke again, and this time Mary tried hard to make the same sounds.
Mulefa,
she said tentatively. Others repeated.
Mulefa,
in her voice, laughing, and even seemed to be teasing the creature who had spoken.
Mulefa,
they said again, as if it were a fine joke.
Well, if you can laugh, I don't suppose you'll eat me,
Mary said. And from that moment there was an ease and friendliness between her and them, and she felt nervous no more. And the group itself relaxed. They had things to do. They weren't roaming at random. Mary saw that one of them had a saddle or pack on its back, and two others lifted the seed pod onto it, making it secure by tying straps around it, with deft and intricate movements of their trunks. When they stood still, they balanced with their lateral legs, and when they moved, they turned both front and back legs to steer. Their movements were full of grace and power. One of them wheeled to the edge of the road and raised its trunk to utter a trumpeting call. The herd of grazers all looked up as one and began to trot towards them. When they arrived, they stood patiently at the verge and let the wheeled creatures move slowly through them, checking, touching, counting. Then Mary saw one reach beneath a grazer and milk it with her trunk, and then the wheeled one rolled over to her and raised her trunk delicately to Mary's mouth. At first she flinched, but there was an expectation in the creature's eye, so she came forward again and opened her lips. The creature expressed a little of the sweet, thin milk into her mouth, watched her swallow, and gave her some more again and again. The gesture was so clever and kindly that Mary impulsively put her arms around the creature's head and kissed her, smelling the hot, dusty hide and feeling the hard bones underneath and the muscular power of the trunk. Presently the leader trumpeted softly and the grazers moved away. The Mulefa were preparing to leave. She felt joy that they had welcomed her and sadness that they were leaving, but then she felt surprise as well. One of the creatures was lowering itself, kneeling down on the road and gesturing with its trunk, and the others were beckoning and inviting her. No doubt about it, they were offering to carry her, to take her with them. Another took her rucksack and fastened it to the saddle of a third, and awkwardly Mary climbed onto the back of the kneeling one, wondering where to put her legs, in front of the creatures or behind, and what could she hold on to? But before she could work it out, the creature had risen, and the group began to move away along the highway, with Mary riding among them.
Because he's Will.
Chapter 8. Vodka.
I have been a stranger in a strange land. The Book of Exodus.
Balthamos felt the death of Baruch the moment it happened. He cried aloud and soared into the night air over the tundra, flailing his wings and sobbing his anguish into the clouds. And it was some time before he could compose himself and go back to Will, who was wide awake, knife in hand, peering up into the damp and chilly murk. They were back in Lyra's world.
What is it?
Said Will as the angel appeared trembling beside him.
Is it danger? Get behind me.
Baruch is dead. My dear Baruch is dead.
When? Where?
But Balthamos couldn't tell. He only knew that half his heart had been extinguished. He couldn't keep still. He flew up again, scouring the sky as if to seek out Baruch in this cloud or that, calling, crying, calling. And then he'd be overcome with guilt and fly down to urge Will to hide and keep quiet and promise to watch over him tirelessly. And then the pressure of his grief would crush him to the ground, and he'd remember every instance of kindness and courage that Baruch had ever shown, and there were thousands, and he'd forgotten none of them. and he'd cry that a nature so gracious could never be snuffed out, and he'd soar into the skies again, casting about in every direction, reckless and wild and stricken, cursing the very air, the clouds, the stars. Finally, Will said,
"Balthamus, come here."
The angel came at his command, helpless. Shivering inside his cloak, in the bitter cold gloom of the tundra, the boy said to him,
"You must try to keep quiet now. You know there are things out there that will attack if they hear a noise. I can protect you with the knife if you're nearby, but if they attack you up there, I won't be able to help. And if you die too, that'll be the end for me. Balthamus, I need you to help guide me to Lyra. Please don't forget that. Baruch was strong. Be strong too. Be like him for me."
At first Balthamus didn't speak, but then he said,
"Yes, yes, of course I must. Sleep now, Will, and I shall stand guard. I shan't fail you."
Will trusted him. He had to, and presently he fell asleep again. When he woke up, soaked with dew and cold to his bones, the angel was standing nearby. The sun was just rising, and the reeds and the marsh plants were all tipped with gold. Before Will could move, Balthamus said,
"I've decided what I must do. I shall stay with you, day and night, and do it cheerfully and willingly, for the sake of Baruch. I shall guide you to Lyra, if I can, and then I shall guide you both to Lord Ezreal. I have lived thousands of years, and unless I am killed, I shall live many thousands of years more. But I never met a nature that made me so ardent to do good, or to be kind, as Baruch's did. I failed so many times, but each time his goodness was there to redeem me. Now, it's not. I shall have to try without it. Perhaps I shall fail from time to time, but I shall try all the same."
"Then Baruch would be proud of you,"
said Will, shivering.
"Shall I fly ahead now and see where we are?"
"Yes. Fly high and tell me what the land's like further on. Walking on this marshland is going to take forever."
Balthamus took to the air. He hadn't told Will everything he was anxious about because he was trying to do his best and not worry him. But he knew that the angel Metatron, the regent from whom they'd escaped so narrowly, would have Will's face firmly imprinted on his mind. And not only his face, but everything about him that angels were able to see, including parts of which Will himself was not aware, such as that aspect of his nature Lyra would have called his demon. Will was in great danger from Metatron now, and at some time Balthamus would have to tell him, but not quite yet. It was too difficult. Will, reckoning that it would be quicker to get warm by walking than by gathering fuel and waiting for a fire to catch, simply slung the rucksack over his shoulders, wrapped the cloak around everything, and set off towards the south. There was a path, muddy and rutted and potholed, so people did sometimes come this way, but the flat horizon was so far away on every side that he had little sense of making progress. Sometime later, when the light was brighter, Balthamus's voice spoke beside him.
"About half a day's walk ahead, there is a wide river and a town where there's a wharf for boats to tie up. I flew high enough to see that the river goes a long way directly south and north. If you could get a passage, then you could move much more quickly."
"Good. And does this path go to the town?"
"It goes through a village, with a church and farms and orchards, and then on to the town."
"I wonder what language they speak. I hope they don't lock me up if I can't speak theirs."
"As your demon, I shall translate for you. I have learned many human languages. I can certainly understand the one they speak in this country."
Will walked on. The toil was dull and mechanical, but at least he was moving, and at least every step took him closer to Lyra. The village was a shabby place, a huddle of wooden buildings with paddocks containing reindeer, and dogs that barked as he approached. Smoke crept out of the tin chimneys and hung low over the shingled roofs. The ground was heavy and dragged at his feet, and there had obviously been a recent flood. Walls were marked with mud to halfway up the doors, and broken beams of wood and loose hanging sheets of corrugated iron showed where sheds and verandas and outbuildings had been swept away. But that was not the most curious feature of the place. At first he thought he was losing his balance. It even made him stumble once or twice, for the buildings were 2 or 3 degrees out of the vertical, all leaning the same way. The dome of the little church had cracked badly. Had there been an earthquake? Dogs were barking with hysterical fury, but not daring to come close. Balthamos, being a demon, had taken the form of a large, snow-white dog with black eyes, thick fur, and tight curled tail, and he snarled so fiercely that the real dogs kept their distance. They were thin and mangy, and the few reindeer Will could see were scabby-coated and listless. Will paused in the centre of the little village and looked around, wondering where to go, and as he stood there, two or three men appeared ahead and stood staring at him. They were the first people he had ever seen in Lyra's world. They wore heavy felt coats, muddy boots, and fur hats, and they didn't look friendly. The white dog changed into a sparrow and flew to Will's shoulder. No one blinked an eye at this. Each of the men had a demon, Will saw, dogs most of them, and that was how things happened in this world. On his shoulder, Balthamos whispered,
"Keep moving. Don't look them in the eye. Keep your head down. That is the respectful thing to do."
Will kept walking. He could make himself inconspicuous. It was his greatest talent. By the time he got to them, the men had already lost interest in him. But then a door opened in the biggest house in the road, and a voice called something loudly. Balthamos said softly,
"The priest. You will have to be polite to him. Turn and bow."
Will did so. The priest was an immense grey-bearded man wearing a black cassock with a crow demon on his shoulder. His restless eyes moved over Will's face and body, taking everything in. He beckoned. Will went to the doorway and bowed again. The priest said something, and Balthamos murmured,
"He's asking where you come from. Say whatever you like."
"I speak English. I don't know any other languages."
"Ah, English,"
cried the priest gleefully in English.
"My dear young man, welcome to our village. A little no longer perpendicular Holodnoye. What is your name? And where are you going?"
"My name is Will, and I'm going south. I have lost my family, and I'm trying to find them again."
"Then you must come inside and have some refreshment,"
said the priest, and put a heavy arm around Will's shoulders, pulling him in through the doorway. The man's crow demon was showing a vivid interest in Balthamos, but the angel was equal to that. He became a mouse and crept into Will's shirt as if he were shy. The priest led him into a parlour, heavy with tobacco smoke, where a cast-iron samovar steamed quietly on a side table.
"What was your name? Tell me again."
"Will Parry, but I don't know what to call you."
"Otyets Semyon,"
said the priest, stroking Will's arm as he guided him to a chair.
"Otyets means father. I'm a priest of the Holy Church. My given name is Semyon, and the name of my father was Boris, so I am Semyon Borisovich. What is your father's name?"
"John Parry."
"John is Ivan, so you are Will Ivanovich, and I am Father Semyon Borisovich. Where have you come from, Will Ivanovich, and where are you going?"
"I'm lost. I was travelling with my family to the south. My father is a soldier, but he was exploring in the Arctic, and then something happened and we got lost. So I'm travelling south because I know that's where we were going next."
The priest spread his hands and said,
"A soldier? An explorer from England? No one so interesting as that has trodden the dirty roads of Holodnoye for centuries. But in this time of upheaval, how can we know that he will not appear tomorrow? You yourself had a welcome visitor, Will Ivanovich. You must stay the night in my house, and we will talk and eat together. Lydia Alexandrovna," he called.
An elderly woman came in silently. He spoke to her in Russian, and she nodded and took a glass and filled it with hot tea from the samovar. She brought the glass of tea to Will, together with a little saucer of jam with a silver spoon.
"Thank you.
The conserve is to sweeten the tea. Lydia Alexandrovna made it from bilberries."
The result was that the tea was sickly as well as bitter, but Will sipped it nonetheless. The priest kept leaning forward to look closely at him, and felt his hands to see whether he was cold, and stroked his knee. In order to distract him, Will asked why the buildings in the village sloped.
"There has been a convulsion in the earth," the priest said. "It is all foretold in the Apocalypse of St. John. rivers flow backward. The Great River, only a short way from here, used to flow north into the Arctic Ocean. All the way from the mountains of Central Asia it flowed north, for thousands and thousands of years, ever since the authority of God, the Almighty Father, created the earth. But when the earth shook, and the fog and the floods came, everything changed. And then the Great River flowed south for a week or more, before it turned again and went north. The world is turned upside down. Where were you when the Great Convulsion came?
A long way from here. I didn't know what was happening. When the fog cleared, I had lost my family, and I don't know where I am now. You've told me the name of this place, but where is it? Where are we?
Bring me that large book on the bottom shelf. I will show you.
The priest drew his chair up to the table and licked his fingers before turning the pages of the Great Atlas.
Here,
he said, pointing with a dirty fingernail at a spot in central Siberia, a long way east of the Urals. The river nearby flowed, as the priest had said, from the northern part of the mountains in Tibet all the way to the Arctic. He looked closely at the Himalaya, but he could see nothing like the map Baruch had sketched. Semyon Borisovich talked and talked, pressing Will for details of his life, his family, his home, and Will, a practiced dissembler, answered him fully enough. Presently the housekeeper brought in some beetroot soup and dark bread, and after the priest had said a long grace, they ate.
Well, how shall we pass our day, Will Ivanovich? Shall we play at cards? Or would you prefer to talk?
He drew another glass of tea from the samovar, and Will took it doubtfully.
I can't play cards, and I'm anxious to get on and keep travelling. If I went to the river, for example, do you think I could find a passage on a steamer going south?
The priest's huge face darkened, and he crossed himself with a delicate flick of the wrist.
There is trouble in the town. Lydia Alexandrovna has a sister who came here and told her there is a boat carrying bears up the river. Armored bears. They come from the Arctic. You did not see armored bears when you were in the north?
The priest was suspicious, and Balthamos whispered so quietly that only Will could hear,
"Be careful."
And Will knew at once why he'd said it. His heart had begun to pound when Semyon Borisovich mentioned the bears, because of what Lyra had told him about them. He must try to contain his feelings.
We were a long way from Svalbard, and the bears were occupied with their own affairs.
Yes, that is what I heard,
said the priest, to Will's relief.
But now they are leaving their homeland and coming south. They have a boat, and the people of the town will not let them refuel. They are afraid of the bears, and so they should be. They are children of the devil. All things from the north are devilish, like the witches. Daughters of evil. The church should have put them all to death many years ago. Witches have nothing to do with them, Will Ivanovich. You hear me? You know what they will do when you come to the right age? They will try to seduce you. They will use all the soft, cunning, deceitful ways they have. Their flesh, their soft skin, their sweet voices. And they will take your seed. You know what I mean by that. They will drain you and leave you hollow. They will take your future, your children that are to come, and leave you nothing. They should be put to death, everyone.
The priest reached across to the shelf beside his chair and took down a bottle and two small glasses.
Now I am going to offer you a little drink, Will Ivanovich. You are young, so not very many glasses. But you are growing. And so you need to know some things, like the taste of vodka. Lydia Alexandrovna collected the berries last year, and I distilled the liquor. And here in the bottle is the result, the only place where not yet Semyon Borisovich and Lydia Alexandrovna lie together.
He uncorked the bottle, filling each glass to the rim. This kind of talk made Will hideously uneasy. What should he do? How could he refuse to drink without discourtesy?
Odyet Semyon,
he said, standing.
You have been very kind, and I wish I could stay longer to taste your drink and to hear you talk, because what you tell me has been very interesting. But you understand I am unhappy about my family and very anxious to find them again. so I think I must move on, much as I would like to stay.
The priest pushed out his lips in the thicket of his beard and frowned. But then he shrugged.
Well, you shall go if you must. But before you leave, you must drink your vodka. Stand with me now. Take it and down all in one. Like this.
He threw back the glass, swallowing it all at once, and then hauled his massive body up and stood very close to Will. In his fat, dirty fingers, the glass he held out seemed tiny, but it was brimming with the clear spirit, and Will could smell the heady tang of the drink and the stale sweat and the food stains on the man's cassock, and he felt sick before he began.
Drink, Will Ivanovich!
The priest cried with a threatening heartiness. Will lifted the glass and unhesitatingly swallowed the fiery, oily liquid in one gulp. Now he would have to fight hard to avoid being sick. There was one more ordeal to come. Semyon Borisovitch leaned forward from his great height and took Will by both shoulders.
My boy,
he said, and then closed his eyes and began to intone a prayer or a psalm. Vapors of tobacco and alcohol and sweat came powerfully from him, and he was close enough for his thick beard wagging up and down to brush Will's face. Will held his breath. The priest's hands moved behind Will's shoulders, and then Semyon Borisovitch was hugging him tightly and kissing his cheeks, right, left, right again. Will felt Balthamos dig tiny claws into his shoulder and kept still. His head was swimming, his stomach lurching, but he didn't move. Finally it was over, and the priest stepped back and pushed him away.
Go, then. Go south, Will Ivanovich. Go.
Will gathered his cloak and the rucksack and tried to walk straight as he left the priest's house and took the road out of the village. He walked for 2 hours, feeling the nausea gradually subside and a slow, pounding headache take its place. Balthamos made him stop at one point and laid his cool hands on Will's neck and forehead, and the ache eased a little. But Will made himself a promise that he would never drink vodka again. And in the late afternoon the path widened and came out of the reeds, and Will saw the town ahead of him, and beyond it an expanse of water so broad it might have been a sea. Even from some way off, Will could see that there was trouble. Puffs of smoke were erupting from beyond the roofs, followed a few seconds later by the boom of a gun.
Balthamos, you'll have to be a demon again. Just keep near me and watch out for danger.
He walked into the outskirts of the scruffy little town, where the buildings leaned even more perilously than the village, and where the flooding had left its mud-stains on the walls high above Will's head. The edge of the town was deserted, but as he made his way towards the river, the noise of shouting, of screams, and of the crackle of rifle fire got louder. And here at last there were people, some watching from upper-floor windows, some craning anxiously around the corners of buildings to look ahead at the waterfront, where the metal fingers of cranes and derricks and the masts of big vessels rose above the rooftops. An explosion shook the walls, and glass fell out of a nearby window. People drew back and then peered around again, and more cries rose into the smoky air. Will reached the corner of the street and looked along the waterfront. When the smoke and dust cleared a little, he saw one rusting vessel standing offshore, keeping its place against the flow of the river, and on the wharf a mob of people armed with rifles or pistols surrounding a great gun, which, as he watched, boomed again. A flash of fire, a lurching recoil, and near the vessel, a mighty splash. Will shaded his eyes. There were figures in the boat, but he rubbed his eyes, even though he knew what to expect. They weren't human. They were huge beings of metal, or creatures in heavy armor, and on the foredeck of the vessel a bright flower of flame suddenly bloomed, and the people cried out in alarm. The flame sped into the air, rising higher and coming closer and shedding sparks and smoke, and then fell with a great splash of fire near the gun. Men cried and scattered, and some ran in flames to the water's edge and plunged in, to be swept along and out of sight in the current. Will found a man close by who looked like a teacher, and said,
"Do you speak English?"
"Yes, yes, indeed."
"What is happening?"
"The bears. They are attacking, and we try to fight them, but it is difficult. We have only one gun, and..."
The fire thrower on the boat hurled another gout of blazing pitch, and this time it landed even closer to the gun. Three big explosions almost immediately afterwards showed that it had found the ammunition, and the gunners leapt away, letting the barrel swing down low.
"Ah, it's no good. They can't fire."
The commander of the boat brought the vessel's head around and moved in towards the shore. Many people cried out in alarm and despair, especially when another great bulb of flame burst into being on the foredeck, and some of those with rifles fired a shot or two and turned to flee. But this time the bears didn't launch the fire, and soon the vessel moved broadside on towards the wharf, engine beating hard to hold it against the current. Two sailors, human, not bears, leapt down to throw ropes around the bollards, and a great hiss and cry of anger rose from the townsfolk at these human traitors. The sailors took no notice, but ran to lower a gangplank. Then, as they turned to go back on board, a shot was fired from somewhere near Will, and one of the sailors fell. His demon, a seagull, vanished as if she'd been pinched out of existence like a candle flame. The reaction from the bears was pure fury. At once the fire-thrower was relit and hauled around to face the shore, and the mass of flame shot upwards and then cascaded in 100 spilling gouts over the rooftops. And at the top of the gangway appeared a bear larger than any of the others, an apparition of iron-clad might, and the bullets that rained on him whined and clanged and thudded uselessly, unable to make the slightest dent in his massive armor. Will said to the man beside him,
"Why are they attacking the town?"
"They want fuel, but we have no dealings with bears. Now they are leaving their kingdom and sailing up the river. Who knows what they will do? So we must fight them. Pirates! Robbers!"
The great bear had come down the gangway, and massed behind him were several others, so heavy that the ship listed. And Will saw that the men on the wharf had gone back to the gun and were loading a shell into the breach. An idea came, and he ran out onto the quayside, right into the empty space between the gunners and the bear.
"Stop! Stop fighting! Let me speak to the bear!"
There was a sudden lull, and everyone stood still, astonished at this crazy behaviour. The bear himself, who had been gathering his strength to charge the gunners, stayed where he was, but every line of his body trembled with ferocity. His great claws dug into the ground, and his black eyes glowed with rage under the iron helmet.
"What are you? What do you want?"
he roared in English, since Will had spoken in that language. The people watching looked at one another in bewilderment, and those who could understand translated for the others.
"I'll fight you in single combat, and if you give way, then the fighting has to stop."
The bear didn't move. As for the people, as soon as they understood what Will was saying, they shouted and jeered and hooted with mocking laughter. But not for long, because Will turned to face the crowd and stood cold-eyed, contained, and perfectly still until the laughter stopped. He could feel the blackbird Balthamos trembling on his shoulder. When the people were silent, he called out,
"If I make the bear give way, you must agree to sell them fuel. Then they'll go on along the river and leave you alone. You must agree. If you don't, they'll destroy all of you."
He knew that the huge bear was only a few yards behind him, but he didn't turn. He watched the townspeople talking, gesticulating, arguing, and after a minute, a voice called,
"Boy! Make the bear agree!"
Will turned back. He swallowed hard and took a deep breath and called,
"Bear, you must agree. If you give way to me, the fighting has to stop, and you can buy fuel and go peacefully up the river."
"Impossible! It would be shameful to fight you. You are as weak as an oyster out of its shell. I cannot fight you."
"I agree,"
said Will, and every scrap of his attention was now focused on this great ferocious being in front of him.
"It's not a fair contest at all. You have all that armor and I have none. You could take off my head with one sweep of your paw. Make it fairer, then. Give me one piece of your armor, any one you like, your helmet, for example. Then we'll be better matched, and it'll be no shame to fight me."
With a snarl that expressed hatred, rage, and scorn, the bear reached up with a great claw and unhooked the chain that held his helmet in place. And now there was a deep hush over the whole waterfront. No one spoke, no one moved. They could tell that something was happening such as they'd never seen before, and they couldn't tell what it was. The only sound now was the splashing of the river against the wooden pilings, the beat of the ship's engine, and the restless crying of seagulls overhead. And then the great clang as the bear hurled his helmet down at Will's feet. Will put his rucksack down and hoisted the helmet up on its end. He could barely lift it. It consisted of a single sheet of iron, dark and dented, with eye holes on top and a massive chain underneath. It was as long as Will's forearm and as thick as his thumb.
"So this is your armor? Well, it doesn't look very strong to me. I don't know if I can trust it. Let me see."
and he took the knife from the rucksack and rested the edge against the front of the helmet and sliced off a corner as if he were cutting butter.
"That's what I thought,"
he said, and cut another and another, reducing the massive thing to a pile of fragments in less than a minute. He stood up and held out a